good morning, friends. It is Friday, and it's time for Friday with Jim. And I'm your host, Jim Wilkins, ably assisted today by Kate Brister on the engineering board over here with all the blinking lights and stuff on it. And I'm happy to have as our guest, we're going to be talking about fair housing and discrimination and those types of situations in Oregon. And I have with me this morning Diane. Thanks for being with us.
You're welcome.
I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about yourself, a little personal history.
Sure. Well, I am the education director over at the Fair Housing Council of Oregon, which is a statewide nonprofit that deals with civil rights and housing. And I've been doing that for the last 12 years. Before that, I worked in community organizing, community education, program management for community action agencies, United Way, and so on. And what I do now is try to prevent illegal discrimination by educating folks around the state. And that could be tenants, social service agencies, landlords, homeowner associations, lenders, homeowner insurance companies, cities, counties, because they have obligations under civil rights laws as well. And well, my grandma used to always say an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. And while our organization is involved in enforcement, we really try to help folks to understand these laws, some of which are aspects are obvious and some are not. But my background is basically in both education, organizing, and nonprofit management. So I'm thrilled to be working with a civil rights organization statewide. And to get a sense of what the issues are in different areas of Oregon is very interesting.
Well, if you find a landlord or a property owner that's discriminating against one sort or another, what kind of enforcement capability mm-hmm. do you have? I mean, how do you mm-hmm. do punishment?
How do we do punishment? Well, first of all, if someone has an issue, they will generally start out by calling our hotline, and we get about 3,000 calls a year. A lot of times what the person with the issue would prefer, and certainly the landlord. A lot of times landlords are ignorant about what their legal responsibilities are. A lot of times we can just advocate and work it out quickly and just move ahead. However, that's not always the case. And in those situations, we will assist someone to file a complaint with HUD or the Bureau of Oregon Labor and Industries, potentially with one of the civil rights attorneys or legal aid attorneys or other attorneys we work with. And in that case, there's an investigation. And if it is found that the landlord did discriminate, there could be a settlement or it could continue into the court system and so on. So I would say a lot of the situations are resolved fairly quickly. Unfortunately, in Oregon, there's no licensing of landlords. There's no requirements like a driver's license or a food handler's license where they would necessarily learn about fair housing, civil rights laws, landlord-tenant laws. So sometimes they act out of ignorance. And so what we try to do is get to them ahead of the game. But if there's a problem, a lot of times it's through notifying them they can't do something that they stop. However, that's not always the case, and we have cases going all the time as well.
But I'm wondering, it seems like this could devolve into kind of a property rights argument in that if I'm a property owner mm-hmm. and I own property, I could argue that it's my property, I can do with it as I want. How do you counter that argument?
Well, I've heard that argument. I've heard the blankety-blank government telling me what to do with my own property. On the one hand, I hear landlords saying tenants have these rights, and then the tenants saying landlords have all these rights. And since everybody feels it's not the way they want, I think it's probably okay on average. A landlord has every right to have the requirements they want on who can live there based on rental history, credit history, how much income they have. And they can decide that as long as it's consistent for all the applicants. They do have to follow, just like they have to follow other laws about habitability. Part of them having the business, even though it's their property, is they do need to follow civil rights laws. I mean, this was kind of the debate back with the Woolworth's lunch counter, in a sense. back in the 60s, where Woolworth said, well, we're a business, we should have the right to serve whoever we want. And the idea was, well, yes, but these people have the right to buy their soda pops. So same thing here. It is their property, and the landlord has the rights to make sure their property is cared for and not damaged or hurt in any way, and that they have people who are going to pay the rent. On the other hand, someone seeking housing, if they have everything they need to move in there, has the right to access their housing. So it is, in fact, a balancing act. The landlord does have the right to rent to who they choose, as long as they're looking at factors like income, credit history, rental history, and so on, as opposed to sexual orientation or race or disability or because they have children or any of the protected classes under civil rights law.
Well, if I'm a tenant and I feel that there's perhaps some kind of discrimination taking place regarding my tenancy, how would you advise a tenant to proceed?
Well, this is why we have a hotline, and I'll probably mention this a couple of times, but the number is 800-424-3247, bilingual English and Spanish. And if someone believes there's been a civil rights violation, they should call us. And we encourage them to do that, even if they're not sure, because in fact, 1 in every 10 acts of illegal discrimination are ever reported. I will say a lot of folks call us with an issue where it doesn't fall under civil rights law. My landlord doesn't like me because I don't pay the rent or something like that. So if it is an issue that could go to another agency or organization, you know, my landlord not fixing my heater, for example, that's a landlord-tenant law issue, not a civil rights issue, we'd refer them to legal aid. But we would sort through whether it is, in fact, a legitimate issue, and if so, we would assist them. What I can tell you right now, that's kind of a headline, is about 50% of the calls we get on the issues we hear about come from folks who have disabilities, because disabilities is a protected class, just like race, religion, sexual orientation, and so on. And a landlord, it's not only that the landlord can't say, I won't rent to you because I have a disability, or treat you different from other tenants because you have a disability, but someone may have special needs. They may need a parking spot close to their unit. They may have been prescribed an assistance animal for a disability, and there's a no pets policy that they would need to have waived. So there's a variety of issues that come up there. But it could be the obvious things, or it could be something like, you know, it's illegal to discriminate against families with children. So if the landlord says your kids can't play outside, or this isn't a good place for kids, or any of those kinds of things, that falls under the law. So to get back to your question, if someone thinks that they have an issue that might fall under civil rights, where they're potentially being treated differently because of, you know, race, religion, source of income, a variety of protected classes, which they can read through on our website, www.fhco.org. They can call us and have us assess with them if there is an issue.
May I ask a question, Jim? I was wondering, in the list of possible discrimination points, is there something that people, if I were going into a situation, I might not necessarily, you know, I can't read the landlord's mind when he refuses me, but are there some things that if you are a stranger, really, in the area, you really don't get it, certain things that you would look for that might think, you know, this might be more than the landlord had said? Trigger phrases? I mean, is there anything like that that tenants are aware of?
That's a really good question, because, of course, nowadays, unlike, you know, 50, 60 years ago, it's very rare that landlords say, gee, it seems like you're Middle Eastern, or your income is from a public assistance program, or you're not legally married. You know, usually a lot of times they don't say that. One of the keys is if they call on the phone and the landlord says they have these units available, and they show up an hour and a half after the landlord sees the renter with their boyfriend of a different race or partner of the same sex or assistance animal for a disability or their little kids or something, and says, oh gosh, you know, since you called, We realized that these had already been rented. But, you know, a lot of times people don't know. They have no idea. One of the things that we do is we do send out secret shoppers. And those could be either, we call them testers, either in response to someone saying, this is kind of weird. I called and then this happened. And sometimes we just send out secret shoppers to see what's happening. And they're not trying to trick or trap anyone. But obviously, if people are being given out information that's different, that's a huge red flag. I will say that usually when people think of fair housing, they think of the applicants that are turned away. We hear more frequently on our hotline from individuals who are tenants in apartment complexes and that are treated differently from their neighbors. They don't have the same consequences for violating the rental agreement, or they're harassed either by the landlord or other tenants, and the landlord doesn't do anything because of their race, religion, and so on, or it could be sexual harassment. And all of that falls under the law as well. So whether you're an applicant or an existing tenant, if you believe you're being treated differently because of any civil rights category, and those get broader all the time, the most recent one is Section 8 voucher holders. A landlord can't say, I don't take HUD, I don't take a Section 8 voucher. So the law keeps expanding. There are more protections. But whether you're an applicant or an in-place tenant, these civil rights laws do apply. And your question is a good one, because a lot of times people have no idea. And landlords will just say, hey, it's not available, when that's not the case. And we're going to lose a lot of those. Mm-hmm.
I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the history of these statutes, and how did this kind of concern come about?
Well, there's a long history in Oregon of segregation, of discrimination, from the very beginning with the Oregon Trail and the fact that it was illegal for African Americans to live here. That was in our Constitution. We were the only state with exclusion laws. One of the reasons we're still a very white state, it was illegal for Chinese to own property, for Japanese to own property. We had restrictive covenants, which still sometimes show up in deeds at title companies, where it says only a Caucasian can purchase this home, but it goes on to say someone of color can live there as a domestic servant. So there's a lot of this stuff. We had a very strong Ku Klux Klan, you know, a lot of history. So sundown laws, discrimination in public accommodations. So the first fair housing law passed in 1959 in Oregon, and that was really a lot of it was due to the leadership of Mark Hatfield, who was governor at the time, but had actually been very active in civil rights since he was a young man. But it didn't really have teeth in it, and it didn't really make a difference. The Federal Fair Housing Act passed in 1968. It made it illegal to discriminate based on race, religion, national origin, or ethnicity, and color. And that was, it was very difficult to get through Congress, more than any other civil rights act, because people were afraid their property values would go down if it was an integrated neighborhood. And the idea, getting back to the question you asked earlier, Jim, that it was the government interfering with property transactions. So the bill didn't go anywhere until April of 1968. Dr. King was assassinated on April 4th. There were then riots in 125 cities, and that's what ultimately enabled President Johnson to finally push it through Congress. Women's movement in the 70s added gender as a protected class. It's illegal to discriminate against men or women. The biggest issue we see under that is sexual harassment. And then in 1988 came the second big federal law, the Fair Housing Amendments Act, that added two protected classes. It became illegal to discriminate against families with kids. And before 1988, about 70% of the rentals were no kids allowed, no children, no pets. You can imagine what that was like. And it made it illegal to discriminate based on disability. Also, for the first time, the law had teeth in it. It became legal for us to do the secret shoppers. People could get damages in lawsuits. Attorneys could get fees. So that really strengthened it. And then Oregon added their own protected classes. It became illegal in Oregon to discriminate based on marital status, source of income, sexual orientation, gender identity. It's illegal to discriminate against survivors of domestic violence. So as time goes on and we become aware of groups that are experiencing discrimination in housing, just like employment and public accommodation, those protections continue to expand.
Well, I'd like to remind our listeners, Kate, that it's Friday here at Coast Community Radio, and we're talking with Diane Hess from the Fair Housing Council of Oregon, and appreciate you being with us, Kate. Thanks.
So I do want to make sure people know how to contact us. We do have a website, and if you're listening to the show and you think, well, I wonder if this is a fair housing issue, we have information, a lot of information on our site, which is www.fhco.org. FHCO is in Fair Housing Council of Oregon. If you think you are a tenant and you may have experienced discrimination, we'd like you to call our hotline. Or if you're a landlord who has questions and wants more information, and that number is 800-424-3247. Again, back to my grandma saying, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. We really want to make sure you have the information you need either way on your rights and responsibilities. Because some things are obvious. Most landlords, of course, know they're not going to refuse to rent to someone because of their race. But they may not understand about families with children. They may not understand about special needs that people with disabilities might have in housing. Things that they just didn't realize that could potentially get them in trouble.
And it's my understanding now that if you have a criminal record of any time, that's a fairly recent addition, that we can't discriminate against people that have had trouble with
right.
the law in their lives.
So kind of another aspect of fair housing, when we go a little deeper, there's obviously intentional discrimination that's illegal. There's also something called disparate impact or discriminatory impact, which the Supreme Court ruled as a legitimate way to look at discrimination last year. And sometimes basically the difference with disparate impact is we look at statistics, an act that might be intentional or unintentional that's discriminatory. And I know that makes no sense. So let me give some examples. There was an apartment complex in Newport where the landlord wouldn't rent to anyone who worked in a fish cannery. Not illegal, and there's a variety of reasons that could come into play, who knows, but more than 90% of the folks who were working in the fish canneries in Newport happened to be Latino. So there's a policy, intentional or not, that would have more of a negative impact on a protected class. Let's say you have a big apartment complex and they say no tricycles anywhere in this community. They don't mention anything about families with children, but statistically, the vast majority of tricycle users tend to be children. So we look at who's impacted by policies. So in general, landlords can have whatever requirements they want on rental history, credit history, criminal history, and a lot of them may have said no criminal history, no arrests, no felonies, whatever, you know, where it's a big blanket rule that's keeping a lot of people out. This new HUD ruling is a disparate impact ruling. They looked at who is incarcerated in our country. And there's a disproportionate number of African Americans and Latinos. So restrictive criminal history policies have more of an impact on those groups. So it doesn't mean that landlords can't screen for criminal history, but they can't do these blanket things. They need to look at crimes that might endanger other residents. They need to look at how long ago they happened. Has there been rehabilitation? So they can't just say, you can never have been arrested or you can never have had any kind of felony. And so this is new. So there are a number of new rulings that come through by HUD and Department of Justice. That's one of them. And a lot of landlords are scrambling right now to kind of figure that out. We are waiting, actually, for more guidance from HUD. But if you are a landlord, that's a red flag you need to look at. And the landlord associations are starting to research crimes and which one should be 2 years or 5 years or whatever. So that is something new, and it's something that landlords are going to need to look at.
What kind of teeth these anti-discriminatory laws? What kind of teeth are involved? In other words, if I'm a landlord and I'm discriminating, what repercussions can I expect?
Well, it really depends on the circumstance. So I have seen settlements for $5,000 up to $500,000. You know, it is going to depend on a lot of things. There's different kinds of relief based on the crime. There's what's going to make the person who was the victim feel whole again. Did they lose their housing? Did they suffer emotional distress? What's going to punitive punish the landlord? Some of the sexual harassment cases I mentioned have really large penalties, or really scary harassment. I'm thinking of one, this was $500,000, where the neighbor repeatedly told the African-American woman that he was going to have her hanging from a tree in the courtyard. You know, so there are those. Then there are ones, for example, where the landlord says, I don't care if it's an assistance animal for a disability, no pets, that might be $5,000. So it could be they have to go to a training, put up a poster, a month's rent. It could be a lot more, depending on a whole lot of things that comes out in the investigation. What did more than one person suffer? So there's a whole lot of factors, and it's quite a range in terms of what damages might look like.
But clearly you're hoping that it doesn't get to that point with outreach and education.
Right.
That we don't have to take these
right.
things to court to get.
And I will say, in most cases, actually, our hotline staff, you know, they do the intake and they contact the landlord, and that takes care of a lot of these things, because the landlord doesn't want to have to go through a legal process usually. And usually the tenant just wants whatever it is worked out. So it's usually everyone's goal to try to work it out through informal resolution and advocacy. But we are at the ready if that does not work, or if it's something that's so egregious, again, that sexual harassment example, where that's not appropriate. So it's very much a case by case that we look at what options the individual wants.
And then there are those cases that have much larger impact, when you see, you know, there's something that's very individual, very specific, and then things that this is going to impact us throughout the state.
Exactly right. And that's one of the ways the law expands. And let me give an example that starts, if I have time, from here on the Oregon coast. There was a case several years ago where a woman was a victim of domestic violence. She got a restraining order against her husband. He actually left the country. He was gone. And she showed the restraining order to her landlord and said, look, this guy's gone. He doesn't live here anymore because of this violent behavior. Then the landlord gave her a 24-hour eviction notice that said she or someone under her control had done a terrible thing and she had to move. So that went into the courts. The argument was discriminating against someone who is a victim of domestic violence is going to have a disparate impact on women, because not all, but the majority of victims are women, and it fell under gender, and she was successful in that case. That led to an expansion of both Oregon state law protecting survivors of domestic violence, and also another federal law, Violence Against Women Act. So that started with a case, just as you described, and that case not only resolved this woman's situation, but then said, hey, you can't just discriminate against someone who's a domestic violence survivor. So yes, we are always looking for cases that might clarify certain aspects of the law that we really don't know, or it isn't, you know, super clear whether it fits or not. And those are ones that many civil rights attorneys are particularly interested in taking those cases.
Now, your group, the Fair Housing Council, do you bring these charges against property owners and tenants?
Occasionally. Most of the time, the individual brings them, and we are simply supporting them and assisting them in that process. But there are some cases where we see a bigger issue, or where our agency has put in a lot of time, that we play an active role. Or there may be an issue where there is not a complainant. A lot of times we've seen, say, issues with homeless shelters, where there's continuing discrimination, but the people, they aren't around, they leave, and yet we know and have evidence of all these examples where we might bring the charges. So it's not the majority of the time, it's occasionally, but yes, in some circumstances we will do that.
But the preponderance of the charges then would be brought about by the tenant complaints?
Correct.
And they would complain to you?
They would start with us. And if we don't work it out, the complaint would be handled either by HUD or the Oregon Civil Rights Division, or we would connect them with an attorney who would work with them.
When does it become a criminal matter?
It depends if it goes from civil to criminal. Sometimes with criminal, I'd say some of the harassment. I mean, right now about 20% of what we hear about involves some harassment. So I think those are the ones where it tends to enter the criminal arena, but most of the time it would be civil. Most of these, even when they file a complaint, settle. So HUD or the Oregon Civil Rights Division, you know, they look at the they look at the paperwork, they talk to witnesses, we might send our secret shoppers, whatever, and they'll often go back and forth, and then both parties agree on a confidential settlement where the landlord pays money or whatever, but it doesn't go beyond that. And so a lot of these things stop along the way before they hit the ultimate ending.
Well, you know, I'm wondering, the secret shopper thing that you talk about, couldn't that be looked at as a form of entrapment?
Originally, that was the argument against it, but it's all regulated. The Supreme Court and HUD laid out all these standards that we follow, and we train all of our testers. They don't even know what they're testing for, the secret shoppers. They don't even know what they're looking for. They just know what they're going to say. They have no idea. And it's pretty fact-based. It's not like we're looking to find something. We're looking to see, in a very neutral sense, what's actually going on here. In fact, if a landlord said, I had secret shoppers come, and they describe something that says, well, how do you feel about all these Mexicans living here? And what do you, you know, we know it's not one of ours. Because they would just say, you know, they'd go through the usual thing that they were looking for a place to live and where they worked, and like anybody looking for an application.
Right. Well, you keep pretty busy doing this then, do you?
Pretty busy because we're a fairly small organization and we cover the whole state. We're here today in Astoria because we're training some landlords and some shelters and some advocates and meeting with some folks, getting some information out. But it's a big state, and so yes, we do keep quite busy.
We're experiencing, you probably know, a real housing crunch here in this area. So does this make it more of an opportunity for difficult cases to come because the opportunities for housing at all are so few?
And this is true in more and more of Oregon, larger and larger areas of Oregon, yes, because of the lack of vacancies overall, especially affordable units. Landlords have kind of their pick of the litter, and a lot of them don't even advertise, and it does make discrimination more likely than when they really are having challenges filling a unit. It makes it harder for us to send out our secret shoppers because the unit needs to be vacant. Mm-hmm. So yes, it does present a challenge. I will say, though, again, we hear far more frequently from individuals who are in-place tenants who feel they're being treated differently from their neighbors, treated more harshly, or harassed because of protected class. So a lot of times, again, people just think of the applicants, but we do hear more often from people who feel they're being treated unfairly while they're living somewhere.
So how long are you going to be in our area today?
For the rest of the day today.
And where at? Where are you
Well, let's
today?
See. We are doing a training at the community college for landlords. We're doing a training for social service agencies. I think is at the Guy Boyington Center, mm-hmm. if I'm saying that correctly.
Judge Guy Boyington Building.
Yes, mm-hmm. yes, for social service agencies and shelters. You know, again, this applies to all dwellings. So we're not just talking about apartments and rental houses. So shelters, transitional housing program, assisted living facilities, adult foster care. Any dwelling is covered by the law. So we want to make sure everybody's aware of their rights and responsibilities.
Well, Diane Hess, really appreciate you being with us here on Friday at Coast Community Radio, but it's time for us to bring this interesting conversation to a halt, and thank you so much. And I'd urge our listeners, Kate, to stick around for Albert Smith, and as always, wonderful Friday folk. So until next week, friends, goodbye.